Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Gardening without chemicals turns out to be the right way to do it, according to my guest today. Jeff Lowenfels has been growing things and writing about it in Anchorage for a very long time, and through that experience he learned to get rid of anything that doesn't naturally belong in his garden. He's written a series of books about it that took the world by storm. And later in the show, we'll hear about a longtime beekeeping expert in Anchorage who's even breeding bees to make it through our cold winters. We're out in the yard on today's show. Stay tuned. For my next guest on Outdoor Explorer, I have someone who I think just about everybody in Anchorage already knows. Jeff Lowenfels has written a gardening column in the Anchorage Daily News for 44 years without ever missing a column. That's got to be some kind of a national record. He's also a very widely read author on gardening. His book, Teeming with Microbes, has been translated into an amazing 11 languages. He's also author of Teeming with Nutrients and Teeming with Fungi, and has been, you know, a fixture in our town for a long time. Thanks so much for being on the show, Jeff.
Well, I certainly appreciate being here. It's always fun.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit. I mean, there's so many topics we could talk about gardening and lawn care. But the one that you have really become a prophet on is not using a lot of chemicals. And that is something that people used and did in the past and have gotten more smarter and smarter about. Tell me sort of why it's not necessary or it's beneficial to use more of the natural techniques.
Well, I think the bottom line is it's just too dangerous to be using chemicals that are either questionable or we certainly know they're not good for us. And when you think about it, we didn't use those chemicals for the longest period of time until about the past, well, since World War II, basically. And they're really not needed, particularly when it comes to a home garden. They're dangerous.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
And I
didn't always think that way, but I've come to be a big believer and proponent in what people call organic gardening.
Organic gardening, including you don't use chemical fertilizer like the kind you buy in a bag.
No. No, definitely not. Not unless it's organic, because I you just don't need it. I mean, we're one thing I've learned writing this garden column over the millions of years that I've been doing it and going to all the meetings of garden writers and everything else, A, most garden writers don't know a damn thing other than what their grandmother taught them, and B, we're susceptible to brainwashing. And the one thing that you can ensure yourself is that you've been brainwashed by the gardening industry somewhere along the way. And I think one of my main jobs is to try to either de-brainwash you, deprogram you, or brainwash you in my direction. But we're definitely oriented towards chemicals, and it's a bad, bad thing, particularly in the state of Alaska, where we've got such a pristine environment.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you didn't always feel this way and you had something of an awakening. And did it really start out with this microrhizomal fungi down in the earth and realizing that they would do more work if you didn't use chemicals? Was that the beginning for you, or where did you have your awakening?
You know, I always tell the story about how my family was intricately involved in the founding of Miracle-Gro. Because my father employed the gentleman who founded the company. He hated working for my father's company so much that he looked around actively every weekend for a different industry to get into and started Miracle-Gro as a result of hating working for my father's company so much.
What did your father do, by the way?
They made butter.
Oh, okay.
All butter is exactly the same. And this guy went to a fancy University of Pennsylvania, his friends were all advertising Gillette Blue Blades and all that kind of great stuff. And he's got butter. It's all the same. So anyway, we were a big Miracle-Gro family as a result. He was a very good friend of my father, and actually came to Anchorage and filmed many commercials on my property in Anchorage that ran at the Super Bowl, et cetera, of Anchorage gardeners talking about using Miracle-Gro. One day, a friend of mine sent me a picture of a nematode being strangled by a fungus that was associated with a root and protecting the root from things like this nematode. And I was so blown away that I did a tremendous amount of research to really understand what was going on in this microscopic world. And it was the second time in my life that I've done something intellectually where the logic was so compelling that it was poetry. The only other time was geometry. So this was like geometry to me. It was like poetry. It all fit together. It's such compelling sense, that I just had to stop using chemicals altogether.
So these fungi are down under the earth, are down under the plants, and they have evolved over many millions of years to symbiotically help those plants grow. And if you use the chemicals, you may be destroying them, right?
Well, oddly enough, they haven't evolved. This is the interesting thing. There are two kinds of fungi that we're interested in as gardeners. These are mycorrhizal fungi. They are the actual fungus that help plants become terrestrial. The reason we have trees is because of these fungi. And they have not really changed in one case 200 million years, in the other case 400 million years, oddly enough. But you're right in that they in return for getting sugars and good things from the plant, they in turn bring the plant all manner of nutrients, which the plant would not be able to get itself. And so 96% of all plants rely on these fungi. And, your garden writer in the Anchorage Daily News, along with the garden writer I might add in the New York Times and every other place in the country, had no idea what they were until 1996. I'd already been writing the garden column for, for 15, 20 years. So it's very interesting that these have just come on the scene. And my partner, Wayne Lewis, my business partner, Wayne Lewis, and I put this first book together, Teaming with Microbes. And, it just caught the wave. It's not only the fungi, it's also bacteria. And depending on what you're growing, your plants prefer a soil that's got more fungi versus more bacteria in it, et cetera, et cetera. The mycorrhizal fungi that we're just discussing, I really didn't really know very much about, and nobody did. And so I had to actually add a section to the book and revise the book. And then ultimately, we learned so much more, I had to write an entire book on the subject. And even since that book has been written, even more has come out. So it's a fascinating field.
And this is because soil scientists in the universities are finding out more about it?
Yeah, it is. And part of the reason is because they now have the capability to be able to grow many more of them in the lab than they used to have before. There's been tremendous advances. When I started writing the book, the advances were in using the microscope and electron microscopy, and there was a blending of different disciplines. And what's happened now is because people can do something that we didn't even dream of back then, they're able to duplicate a lot of microbes in the lab that they were not able to grow before. And it's an interesting story. It really doesn't have anything to do with gardening. And right. Frankly, people can read the Anchorage Daily News on Fridays and pick up all the gardening information they want. This information is not the kind of stuff I put in the paper. But back at Northeastern University in Boston, a student came up with an idea that revolutionized how we study soil microbes. And for those who just, the general background is that if you have a healthy soil microbial population, then you're going to have a healthy garden, and you're not going to need to use the chemicals, because all the way up the food chains, everything is going to take care of and keep in check the bad guys. You won't necessarily have them all disappear, but their populations will be kept in check. And what was the problem was that we were never able to grow any more than about 1% of these microbes, because what did we grow them in? The Petri dishes. We all remember those from high school, right? With a little auger, chicken soup or something in there, and the problem was not all microbes eat that stuff. They eat different things. They eat other microbes. They eat soil. They don't eat Petri dish goods. And so how do you grow them? And this guy came up with an idea. He came up with a little sort of like a Tic Tac box, very small Tic Tac box. You put the microbe you want to grow in there, and you stick that box in the soil environment where it would normally grow, but it's retained inside that box. It's got these sieve-like membranes that allow all the good soil gooky stuff to go into it, but the microbes stay in there, and they multiply. And all of a sudden, we can now grow 90% of the microbes that are in the soil. And as a result of that, have developed, last I counted, was able to read, something like 16 new antibiotics that we couldn't grow before. So anyway, there's been tremendous advances in all of this stuff. And how fortunate are we that a lot of these advances apply to our favorite hobby, gardening.
There you go. It's Outdoor Explorer. My guest is Jeff Lohenfels, the gardening columnist who's been writing for Anchorage audiences for 44 straight years without taking a break. And he's written these important books, Teeming with Microbes being the most famous of them. And he's on with me, Charles Woolforth, on Outdoor Explorer. So, Jeff, what I hear you saying is not just that organic gardening is nice or that it's positive or it has, you know, it's feel good, but it's actually the best way to garden.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And not only is it the best way to garden, well, let's just start right here. You're putting this food in your mouth. You're eating it. Do you want to feed yourself Roundup? Do you want to feed yourself, these unbelievable chemicals you can't pronounce that are organophosphates that we know cause damage if you use them at the wrong dosage? I mean, these are some serious, serious problems. And yet our government is sort of blind to the idea that not only are we using them, but we're misusing them and that we don't need them. They're not necessary. Mm-hmm. What are we growing that we want to douse with a chemical so badly so that we can put it on our table and feed our kids? It's just incredibly. And as I was said before, particularly when you live in Alaska, I mean, we live in the last place in the United States of America that has the opportunity to not have Roundup glyphosate, which is a weed killer that California has now declared it causes cancer based upon the World Health Organization's determination, and is demanding that be labeled on every glyphosate product, and it should be. Our railroad uses that to clear off the tracks. But every river and stream and water body in the lower 48 states has glyphosate in it. We are the only place in the country where that is not true, and yet our railroad thinks that, okay, we'll just spray because we need to do it on our track. Mm-hmm. This is bad. You know, this kind of stuff we don't need to be doing in Alaska. We shouldn't be doing in Alaska.
So in terms of how I'm taking care of, I do a little gardening, but I also have this darned lawn that I have to take care of. And I see my neighbors spraying stuff around to get rid of the dandelions. They don't bother me too much. I just sort of mow them down. And I've also learned from you over the years, I don't have to rake and I don't have to throw away the grass that comes out of the mower as well, because that'll just go down into the lawn and make it grow better. Now, give us some examples of things that people should be doing. Maybe just talking about lawns, the best practices for an Alaskan lawn.
Right, right. Well, clearly the best practice is to let those dandelions go, unfortunately. We've lost that war. You know, when there were one or two of them in your lawn and you could pull them up by hand, that was the time to do it. But by now, particularly in Anchorage, the war is over. The dandelion has won. We better get used to liking them. It's unfortunate that they don't come in different colors. I've always maintained that if they came in five or six different colors, people would be planting them in their lawn. But the bottom line is, you're right, you mow those down. This time of year is a great time because we're between what I call flushes of dandelions. Let your lawn grow tall. Outcompete those new seedlings that are coming from the seeds that blew out earlier in the spring. Do not fertilize the lawn unless you think it's a sickly green. I might add that the Miracle-Gro fertilized lawn is a sickly green as well. We all know what a healthy lawn looks like. There's no reason to knee-jerk and feed your lawn. We don't need to do it. I've never, ever put fertilizer on my front lawn. I use compost tea occasionally. You just don't need to do it if you're keeping the grass clippings and the leaves that come down in the fall mulched up and feeding the microbes in the soil.
So you're feeding the lawn with your clippings.
Exactly. And those clippings are being broken down by the microbes that are there. And those microbes are feeding other microbes that are then in turn feeding the plant, which is what they want to do. And right now, you want to let that lawn grow as tall as you possibly can stand it, so that you can sort of so that you can outcompete the other weeds.
And when we say right now, we're recording in early August, and so that would be the time to be letting it really go. Yeah.
Right, in between flushes, and we usually get two flushes of dandelions, one in the spring, one a little bit later towards the end of August, and you mow those down. You're absolutely correct. Now, a lot of lawns in Anchorage are turning to moss, which I take great joy in, because I think moss is a terrific lawn cover if you need to have a lawn. It's beautiful, it's green, it's soft, it's very interesting. But a lot of people don't like it. Unfortunately, our soils are such that they want to return to what they were. They're very acidic, and they turn to moss. Moss just is a natural thing in all of the Anchorage lawns. They will eventually all become moss. The way to change that is to change the pH, but it's a difficult thing to do. And this sort of underscores the problem with gardening. We all want it to be like a pet. Sit, Rover. Do exactly what I say. And unfortunately, it's not a pet. And we can't always have the garden be what we want it to be. And I think that's something people need to adjust and adapt to and accept. Very important thing, particularly if you live in Alaska, where there are so many, you know, things that can go wrong in such a short period of time.
So, in a way, we need to adapt to where we live rather than try to make it look like, you know, England in the 18th century and where we're lords and ladies of the manor or something like that. It's try to be more Alaskan.
Absolutely. And if I had another 40 years to write garden columns, and I think you'll find over the next whatever years I have left, that is exactly the theme of my columns. We are making the biggest mistake in the world by trying to import all these non-native perennials to make our gardens look like the ones we had in the lower 48 states. They don't support the insect populations that we should be having here. Those insect populations support the salmon. They support the bird populations. It all feeds into each other. And when we ruin the system, as we have in the lower 48 states, I think somewhere in the vicinity of 80 to 90% of all of the plants in the lower 48 states are non-natives. That means that the populations of animals, insects, are they're not the right ones. They're not what we're supposed to have. We don't want to do that to Alaska. We've already caused problems in our riparian areas, et cetera, by, mountain ash trees. And it's just, what have we done? Why are we doing that? So, yeah, that's a very important point. We need to really adapt our gardening to where we live. And we live in Alaska, and we do things differently here. We do things the right way.
So what would I find if I walked through your garden that I might not find in the garden that's supplied from Lowe's or Home Depot with the very typical stuff?
Well, you'll find some exotics. You'll find some weeds that have gotten out of hand that I can't control because I don't use Roundup. But I think what you'll find is, that mostly my yard, or I should say our yard, because my wife is the big gardener in the family these days. I have terrible arthritis. Our yard tries to reflect as much of the surroundings and nature as we possibly can. I've got a gigantic section of the yard that's just pristine. It's just all woods. It's never been touched, never been gardened. I don't even walk in it. And it's what I try to emulate with the rest of the yard. Unfortunately, I'm a sucker for a lawn. So I've got some pretty darn big lawns. But that's because I like to dance on the lawn using the lawnmower.
There you go.
But other than that, I think it's a pretty plain garden because I don't have a lot of the exotics that I would love to have. Just because I'm really getting to the point where I just think we've made a serious mistake on so many things. I've got so many friends that own, beautiful nurseries and whatnot, and I just want to tell them, please.
Going the wrong way.
Annuals are one thing, but it's these perennials that we're bringing in, these trees that we shouldn't be bringing in. Big mistake.
Yeah, let's stop messing with it. But after all these years and you devoted so much of your life to it, you must get a great deal of pleasure from being in the garden and working in the garden and just having that be a center of your life.
Well, I get more of a pleasure in going to the Alaska Botanical Garden, for example. And walking around there and seeing other people wander through gardens and taking notes and You know, I get much more pleasure walking through cars and having somebody coming up and saying, "Gee, you know, what do I do about X, Y, and Z?" And we sit there and we talk about it. You know, it's the comradeship. It's the that's a good idea. I'm gonna do that myself kind of stuff. It's, you know, it's the one we communicate. Gardeners love each other. You know, they don't fight. Mm-hmm. They work together. They share ideas. Sure, there's an occasional secret, but darn rare. You know, and they applaud each other when they do something great. It's the way we should be. It's the way our politics ought to be. It's a great metaphor for life.
Yeah, it's a gentle and nurturing side of life, which we all need more of right now. Yeah.
Yep. And you have to think about what you're doing. And, you know, mm-hmm. you have to. And there are choices, and some of the choices are good ones. I think the organic choice is the good one, and the chemical one is just unfair. It's just the wrong way to go. It's not fair to your neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. So when you see your neighbor spraying those dandelions, you know, you call me up. I'll give me their telephone numbers. I'll get in touch with them.
All right. Great. Thank you so much, Jeff. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, a pleasure, and we'll have to do it again.
Absolutely. Jeff Lowenfels has been with me. He's been writing his gardening column, the Anchorage Daily News, for 44 years. His books are Teeming with Microbes, which is in 11 languages, Teeming with Nutrients, and Teeming with Fungi. And he was kind enough to share some of his ideas with us today on Outdoor Explorer. Stick with us as the show continues. It's Outdoor Explorer. The Market and Garden Report comes from Boise, Idaho. We're going to hear correspondent Guy Hand on why so many of us are interested in growing our own food. To learn more, you can reach their site through outdoorexplorer.org. Just click on today's show.
A recent survey says over a third of U.S. households grew vegetables in 2009. That's nearly a 20% increase over the year before, or 7 million new families growing food. But why? I recently wandered through a season-long gardening class taught by Clay and Josie Erskine, asking students, why do you garden?
I was telling my sister, I want to get back to our roots, you know, and she said, what do you mean your roots? And I'm like, human roots, you know, when we actually grew our own food and nothing came prepackaged and, you know, we were aware of where our food was coming from.
To be able to turn our yard into something that's fruitful rather than just a plot of grass that looks nice, to actually have it work for us and feed us.
To me, that's a great thing you can do for family and friends, is feed them. And to feed them fresh food is even more satisfying.
I like getting dirty. It's fun. It's lovely. And, you know, you walk away with the fruits of your labor and just you enjoy all week long.
So what are you doing right now?
Right now I'm just pulling some weeds out of the raspberries. They're getting a little big.
And do you think it's worth it with all the manual labor that's involved?
Oh, it's peaceful. I mean, once you get into a rhythm and just start weeding, you can pretty much think about everything else except the weeding.
For me, I feel like one of my jobs as a mother is to teach my children how to sustain themselves. I just want to have the skills to be able to teach them how to grow food and to know where the food comes from.
The more work you put into it, the commitment grows, and the connection to the land grows, and the connection to the result grows, and by the end, the rewards far outweigh what you put into it, to me anyways.
It's a nice opportunity to get outside when you're in an urban area and connect to blackbirds and the wind.
Everyone seems to bring so much good energy here that you leave full.
And I get to garden with other people, which has been kind of fun. And something Josie said, that, you know, once you garden in a group, it's kind of hard to go back to gardening alone. And I love that, and I keep thinking about that.
But it also allows us the opportunity to come out here by ourselves and just enjoy the garden. So you can be out here with a great group of folks, or you can be out here when no one else is out here, and it's all yours. It's spectacular.
A few answers to the question, why do you garden? For the Market and Garden Report, I'm Guy Hand.
This one?
That one needs a little water.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Well, it's Outdoor Explorer, and we have talked a lot about food, and we just have done a little bit on gardening, but we have never talked on the show about beekeeping. And I know several people who do it, and it's really, really cool and really interesting. And I have really enjoyed watching the process of harvesting honey and sort of looking at how the bees make these amazing hives that they live in. And they're really fascinating animals, and I guess insects. And so I wanted to learn more about it. And I invited my next guest to come in. Keith Malone has a business called Alaska Honeybee Products. And he breeds bees, and he works on overwintering bees and honeybees in Alaska, which is kind of a new thing. And has been at it for quite a while. So thanks for coming in, Keith.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So to start with, let's talk about these particular bees that are used by beekeepers. They're not native to Alaska, right? I mean, these are bees that are being imported.
The current paradigm in the U.S. is there are no indigenous honeybees.
Really? So where are they coming from?
Well, they all came from Europe or Africa or Asia.
Uh-huh.
Or Middle East, actually.
Okay. And so they're a creature that is here only because it's cared for, essentially.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially in Alaska because of how cold it is in the winter.
You have to care for them if you're going to winter them, yes.
Yeah.
It's essential.
So most of the folks that I've met who do this as a hobby, they go out and buy bees and keep them for a season. And then they kill them in the fall, and then they get more bees in the next season.
Yeah, I've heard of that too.
Yeah. So how does that work? Where are those bees coming from, and who's raising them? Do they come in the mail or something?
Well, you know, long ago they used to come in the mail, long ago, mm-hmm. before my time. The Sears used to be a good supplier of honeybees back in the day.
Huh.
Yeah. But nowadays we fly them up from California normally.
Okay. And sort of like certain the shipment is here and it's time to set up your hives? Or how does that work?
You got a pre-order,
mm-hmm.
and you have to have your equipment ready
mm-hmm.
when they arrive. And they arrive on usually around April.
Okay.
First week of April to the last week of April.
Yeah. And so how do you set up a hive? How does that work?
Well, you have to get equipment.
Yeah.
You have to build your equipment if mm-hmm. you haven't gotten it mm-hmm. pre-assembled
yep.
by somebody who might do that for you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a new beekeeper, first thing you want to do is really study up.
Yeah.
And find yourself a mentor,
mm-hmm.
one who is successful
right.
at what you want to do.
Because although this is a practice that's been done for thousands of years, it's not at all simple. There's a lot to know.
There's so much to know. I don't know. I don't know it all. And mm-hmm. I'm still learning every year, mostly from observation now and asking those people who know a lot about beekeeping good questions
mm-hmm.
so that I can fine-tune my art.
Yeah. So you have this box which has these spaces in it that where the bees can build their hive.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's different types of bees in the box. There's a queen bee, and then there's like workers and how does all that work?
There's three types of bees. Okay. A cast. There's queens, which are females, which are fully developed to be productive. They can reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
Workers don't have developed organs for doing so.
For reproduction.
Mm-hmm. And the drones, they're males. And they're developed from an unfertilized egg that has got the genetics of the queen that laid it only.
So when you set up your hive, you have to have a queen.
You have to have a queen. That's essential. In fact, that is... Well, I think it's the most important member of the hive,
uh-huh.
but they need them all. They need all of them, even the drones.
It's this complicated community that all works. Everybody has their own job.
Yeah, and they're really good at it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So when the queen just stays there, right? She doesn't. She mm. once the hive is set in a place, like she pretty much stays at place, or does she fly around?
Oh, no. Once she's mated, and you're going to get a mated queen in your package,
mm-hmm.
which is technically. Terminology, it's package bee.
Hmm.
is what it is. And what you get when you get your package bee, it's going to have a queen in it that's mated already.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's just customary.
And then they will just stay in the hive, hopefully permanently.
Well, I've seen them abscond from hives after being hived up. So there's no guarantees with honeybees.
Right. If all goes well, they'll
if
stay
all goes
there.
Well, they'll stay there. Yeah, and then if they're really good, and if you you know, they could swarm if they can build up and just become a very strong force and decide they want to swarm.
And that's
good. it's good for them. That's what they do is procreate. That's on their mind.
That's how they create another hive.
Yeah, in the springtime when they wake up, they got one thing on their mind. Mm-hmm. Let's do it again.
Okay. So, but in the course of it, if things are going normally and you've got your box set up and your queen is in there and your workers and your drones are all doing their business, they are going out and collecting
nectar, pollen, and propolis.
And they're creating this honey, and you don't have to do anything
and
to
water.
That.
Pardon now?
And as a beekeeper, how do you make sure that bees are happy and they go out and create honey? Do you have to do anything or just leave them there?
Well, you know, there are things that you can do. As a new beekeeper, you're just going to be in there looking, you know, learning. And you're going to be in too often, and that's recommended. I even recommend, get in there and look as often as you feel like you need to. Mm-hmm. Have a purpose if you can, you know, but new beekeepers usually get in a little more than they should, which is, like I said, it's okay.
Because they're learning.
Once you learn more and more, you learn what to do and what you don't need to do.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, but it takes time to learn. And as so much, it's hard to learn it all at once.
Of course. So where do they, I mean, they're going for flowers. I mean, we think of them. Yeah. And so is there a certain amount of area that needs to be set aside for a successful hive? In other words,
how many hives can they fit in a square mile, for
in
instance.
A subdivision or something? Yeah,
that's all arbitrary to density of forage for them.
Okay,
you know, if it's sparse, then it's not going to handle as many hives as otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really only one way to figure that out:
just put a hive in,
put a hive out, and see if they do good.
See how much
if they
honey
do
you
really
get.
Good. Maybe you can put two or three or, but you know. Yeah, it's arbitrary to
sort of what
to
the
available
like.
Forage.
Mm-hmm. So suppose you've done that and you've got a good area,
right. And
the bees are happy, and now the season is over. How much honey would you expect to take from a successful hive in Anchorage?
Arbitrary, also depending on your method and style of beekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will take all their honey, and then.
I mean, assuming that you're not going to overwinter the bees.
Right.
Like, just to get a scale, it's like you know, a pound is like 100 pounds. I mean, we're somewhere in between.
Yes. You know, every hive is individual. You know, I usually don't discuss not keeping bees through the winter because I'm adamant against it, not keeping bees through the winter.
Uh-huh.
And so when I talk about bees, it's usually how I keep them. And how I expect that they should be kept if you're expecting to overwinter them.
Okay.
And so a good average for those who don't take all their honey, you can get up to 150 pounds taking all their honey.
Wow, that's a lot of honey.
And
that's more honey than anybody can use, really. I mean, you'd have to give a lot of it away.
Individual, yeah, but some families can use that. But... what was it? Where were we?
Sort of overwintering, you need to leave some of that in the...
I never get into a sanctuary and take honey out of that, which is, the sanctuary is where the brood nest is and the complementary pollen and honey that's around it in place where they put it, where they need it in the winter.
Okay.
And so, you know, a good average for that type of method would be 30 to 50, maybe 60 or more pounds, depending on the year and the hive.
Still a lot of honey.
Yeah. Some hives I've gotten close to 150 off a single hive and still had enough honey to winter.
Wow.
Of which it did winter.
So, and then the wintering is obviously a challenge because it's very cold here and it's much colder than these particular insects would be used to.
I can give you some statistics.
Okay.
In the lower 48, I was talking to some researchers that came up this summer, and they went through my hives and did some analysis. And I asked them a question. I said, how's the overwintering success in the lower 48? They said, oh, about 40% death rate. And I've got students, including myself, who get between 50 and 80% through the winter. So we're doing as good as they are down in the lower 48.
All right, cool. So how do you do it? How do you keep them alive in cold weather?
You got to give them, we have cold weather with humidity, and we have cold weather with freeze-thaw.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's very important to have lots of ventilation where they can take care of it. They have the ability to bring in as much air as they want.
Oh, I see.
Or extract as much as they want from the hive. Mm-hmm. I think that's very important.
Do you bring them inside then?
Some people do, and I have, that's a perfectly good strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I like to keep mine outside. I've done years and years of experiment where I never fed. I never wrapped them, never gave them any protection, and I still get bees through the winter.
Hmm.
Maybe not a large percentage.
Mm-hmm.
Styrofoam hives outside can get up to 80% success rate.
Wow. So that's a styrofoam in order to hold the heat in, throw the bees' heat in.
It actually, what it does is mostly is it buffers the temperature differences between night and day.
Mm.
You know, the highs of the day and the lows of the night.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as drastic a change to them, so they can adjust their cluster as it changes. It does buffer that.
Interesting. So then when springtime comes, have they died down to just a few bees and are ready to start reproducing?
There is attrition.
Yeah.
And they do die back through the winter because of natural attrition.
Mm-hmm.
And some strains, they will keep a small patch of brood even in the wintertime with the resources that they have inside the hive. And others will shut down completely. Those are the kind that I like, where they don't start brooding up until fresh pollen is coming in the spring.
Hmm. Interesting. We are talking about beekeeping, and my guest is Keith Malone, who is the owner of Alaska Honeybee Products and overwinters bees, breeds bees, obviously knows a ton about bees, and I'm learning a lot, and I hope you are too, on Outdoor Explorer. My name is Charles Woolforth. So what about the hazard of being around bees and getting bee stings, I'll start with that, I guess. I mean, do you get stung by bees all the time, or is that just not something you have to worry about?
Well, yeah, I get stung all the time.
Really?
Pretty much.
Uh-huh.
If you want to say, you know, every year. But yeah, it was just the other day. I got stung up pretty good. I was in a little too early. I had a lot to do in the beehives, and the first one I got into did not want me there.
Yeah, so they're defending their hive, and they just go after you.
Right now, see, the nectar sources has diminished.
Mm-hmm,
and pretty much all that's out there mm-hmm. is what they call incidental.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're protecting everything they got.
Mm-hmm.
And so unless they're flying like mad during the day right now, you're going to probably have a hive that is ready to eat you up.
Okay. And that when they sting, that's just their way of getting you to go away.
Yeah, they're being defensive rather than aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is it with a big hive with hundreds and hundreds of bees, thousands of bees, if they all stung you once, they'd kill you very easily, right?
Well, if you're anaphylactic, everybody's allergic.
I mean, it might only take you a couple if you're anaphylactic, but I mean,
it'll only take one,
mm-hmm.
less than one.
But in terms of like, if I think of like a huge hive of bees being on somebody, I mean, that's like, it's a terrifying prospect.
That's terrifying. That's the one thing that scared me the most when I was a beginner beekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
Just the thought of that. With all my study that I was doing prior to getting the bees, I came to the point where in the book we were talking about the bee sting, and I had a...
Not sure you want to do it anymore.
Yeah, right. I really want to do this.
Yeah, yeah. So, but that doesn't happen very often, or...
I don't mind getting stung.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'll tell you right now, I believe that the bee sting is the most valuable product of the hive.
Why is that?
Because a bee sting is a bee sting is histamine, And so if you need, it'll send, your body will send histamines there and produce more histamines to keep at it. And so if you've got a low immune system, it's quite possible that it'll stimulate that system.
Interesting.
In fact, 70% of MS patients who try bee sting therapy, 70% of them experience a positive result, not necessarily 100%, but a positive result.
Interesting. So do you, is there any hazard to beekeeping where if you made a mistake and like you had a beehive that swarmed, that it could attack somebody or something like that?
Swarms are out to look for a home. They they are the most docile they'll ever be.
Okay.
Because they, first off, they fill up with honey before they take off. They're all tanked up. They're a little bit slower. They're what we call drunk with honey. And they're just looking for a home. They have nothing to protect, nothing to defend. And so unless they've been hanging on a branch for several days, they're still drunk with honey and very docile. I don't even use any gear at all or anything when I go to retrieve a swarm. You know, swarms are nothing to be afraid of.
Interesting.
It's good to call a beekeeper and maybe remove them so that
what they're doing.
So they can become, so they can get into a home.
And they're valuable, right?
And they're valuable. Oh yes, a big swarm. I'd hate to tell you how valuable they are.
Oh, I would love to hear it.
I estimate them at about $500 because of what they can produce.
Wow.
Yeah, a good 10-pound swarm, that's a one that would fill a deep, high body. I figure it's worth about $500.
Interesting.
As far as what it can produce and what it is as far as a, you know, a package of bees costs $200 or better. So a 10-pound swarm is twice the amount of bees as in a package bee.
Yeah. So is this something that people can do like right in the middle of town? They could do it sort of
Well, there's
wherever.
Laws that they have in town here that allow beekeepers to keep their bees here in town on certain lots and certain locations and orienting them in a certain way.
You need to do some research.
Just a tiny bit. Yeah, just ask a beekeeper.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know how to set them up. And if you find yourself a mentor, they should come out and even help you position where to put your hive.
So we talked a little bit earlier in the show about organic gardening and avoiding the use of chemicals in gardening.
I do organic gardening myself.
Yeah, and all the sense that that makes. And I'm curious about the purity of the environment in terms of how it affects bees. Do you feel like the chemicals or pesticides that people use harm bees, or
well,
is
know,
that
I
an
can't,
issue?
I can't tell you which ones, but it was just... Today I was talking to a gentleman who we were trying to figure out what happened to his bees. He gave me some pictures. I asked him some questions, you know, and got into what he saw when he got in. And I think he got a poison kill. And it happens. I've had people call me up, what happened to my bees? You know, and I go out and look, and it looks like they've been poisoned, you know. And so,
yeah.
But the only way to really verify this is to... take a sample and send it into Bettsville, Louisiana, where the USDA's AFIS is, and or someplace like the University of Maryland or Cornell University, where they have, you know, honeybee programs. And you know, I can't say for sure. All I can say is I've seen it. Something that is considered poison kill. And those who do experience these, I suggest that they get a sample and get it in if you can, and just verify this. And so we
can. It's probably because somebody's talk, using
so
something out there. Yeah.
So I can answer your question better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we all want to live in a pure environment, and bees and pollinators are a really important part of our environment.
Most important.
We really should not be running around killing them.
We should not be running around killing them intentionally. And also, we shouldn't be killing them.
By careless use of chemicals.
What do we call that? That'd be incidental.
So when you go to buy honey, like in the farmer's market or even at the grocery store, you'll see, you know, honey that's labeled by what kind of flower it comes from. And I've noticed
floral source.
I've had, you know, homemade honey that was so delicious and so far beyond any kind of like grocery store honey I've ever had before that I know that there's something to this. Is it the flour, the type of flour the honeys are that the bees are using that alters the flavor of the honey, or how is
there's
that flavor controlled?
A lot of things that can alter or influence the flavor of honey. Heat can change the flavor of honey, and floral sources can change the flavors of honey. Fireweed is light and it has very little aftertaste to it, where a darker honey will have a little more of a bite. You know,
I don't understand how you could control that. It seems like the bees would get whatever kind of
flavor
they
want. Really can't control that unless you find a floral source that is
really large.
Really large in numbers greater than anything else around here.
So many acre area, and you put your hive in the middle of it or something like that?
Well, if you put your hives in a place that's predominantly one floral source or another, you can call it that.
Does anything about the bees or the breeding of the bees alter the flavor of the honey? Or why, I know you are into breeding bees. What are you looking for when you're doing that?
I'm looking for a bee that's wintering Alaska. That's first thing on my my program is to winter bees successfully. And if that happens, then honey comes second and will come.
Yeah. And so that is something you could breed for. Interesting.
Yes.
So how do you go about breeding bees? That sounds like a challenging task.
The bees do it themselves pretty much. I just...
you're breeding for a goal, right?
Yeah, and so I look for those genetics that are coming from overwintered stock.
Which ones did the best?
Yeah, okay. And good ones to boot.
Yeah, and so you're slowly, that takes many, many years, obviously.
And it's going to take more in my lifetime. I'm hoping that there are other people that are coming along already and, doing similar things and breeding their own bees and stuff right here in Alaska. Yeah.
So do you feel like the breeding aspect is one of the causes of your success?
I think animal husbandry in itself helps overwintering, because in the wild, honeybees, one of their strategies for overwintering is splitting, doubling their chances.
I see.
And so as a beekeeper, if you want to follow the bee and what they're doing and give them the success that they're seeking, you may have to do a little animal husbandry for them, for yourself also. So say you have two hives. Chances are you're not going to get those through the winter because of percentage. It might be those two might be the 20 to 40% that ain't going to make it. So... if you can increase your chances by having one or two more, a split, even a nuke, we've gotten small units up in through the winter up here. So it's not the size of the colony that makes it through the winter. It's whether they're organized enough, they got enough feed, they got a good queen, got enough bees, the cavity ain't too big for them, depending on the size of their cluster. All the hives are individual, and so you have to treat them individual. Because, if they can't fill three boxes, you got to put them in two instead.
Right, right.
And so forth.
There's so much to this. It seems like it must be a fascinating hobby, but also kind of an all-consuming hobby.
It's consuming me, pretty much, along with my garden, which is an acre.
Okay.
So I keep myself pretty busy with all that.
I guess
and
so.
I try to help as many beekeepers as I can through the summers because I feel it's my job to help.
Well, what is it about this that drives you or that attracts you to it? What makes it a special thing for you to do?
Well, I tell you, in the beginning, it was because I wanted to, the self-sufficiency thing, and make some things for yourself, to have a garden,
Yeah.
And I was always into gardening, so honeybees was something that, when I was a kid, I was intrigued. I was never guided. So... it was when I was like 35 or so before I started getting into it, and so I was attracted to producing some honey for myself like that, and that's what most people or beekeepers get into it in the beginning is want to get a little honey.
And then pretty soon they've got more honey that they could possibly use.
Oh, yeah, they usually get more. You know, they give away to their neighbors or make a small business out of it.
Very fun. Very interesting.
And so now it's more about the bees to me than it is about the honey. You know.
Do they have a personality? I mean,
each individual hive can have a personality. You know, every time you get in it, they're going to be a little mean. If they're not, then they can change their attitudes too overnight, depending on conditions, weather, nectar availability.
So you've got to really be focused on what's going on there to sort of be tracking what's happening with them.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at the weather all the time.
Sounds like you can't go on vacation either.
At the end of the season. This year, I think, we're going to North Carolina for a visit.
All right. Was it a good season?
This year was a pretty good season in most areas, but I've had reports here in Anchorage that it was a little light in some areas.
Which would be?
It might be hive density that's causing this problem.
Too many hives in too small an area, or the alternate would be not as many flowers, or the flowers not blooming at the right time?
Yeah, we had good flowers this year. I'd put it towards, as somebody who sells bees, like myself, I've noticed in the past 5 years that the interest has threefold in bees.
Super popular. Yeah. I know people who've just started out for sure.
Yeah.
And have mishaps, and all kinds. I guess everybody has a few mishaps.
I had mishaps this year. Yeah, we all do. We all do. All beekeepers do. You gotta just keep learning. You know, you make a mistake, you change your plan a little. You know?
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And so you think people should give it a try if they want to?
I think they should give it a try if they really want to get into something that's going to keep them busy thinking. It's a lot of thinking, a lot of reading, a lot of talking, learning what others are doing.
Find a friend first and watch them do it for a year.
Well, that doesn't hurt at all. Right.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you, Keith. I really find this fascinating, and I really appreciate your time coming in.
All right. I'm really glad to be here. I'm really glad you asked me to come in.
Good. Keith Malone is Alaska Honeybee Products, and please stay with us. It's Outdoor Explorer. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'm Charles Wolforth. This is Outdoor Explorer. Chemicals sprayed on our backyards, city parks, and industrial agriculture have cumulative and lasting effects. We can all help in our own backyards with simple, easy, and fun projects that reduce the effects of chemical sprays. An outfit called Good Dirt Radio has the details in this report from Durango, Colorado, via the Public Radio Exchange.
Welcome to Good Dirt Radio, reporting on positive solutions taking root. Despite marketing spin and availability, pesticides, herbicides, and chemical fertilizers are not very safe for humans or the environment. When sprayed on our backyards, city parks, and in industrial agriculture, as they are across the nation, cumulative doses of toxic residue in the biosphere can have lasting effects. This overuse of chemicals is suspected to be a cause of the widespread bee and bat colony collapse and is affecting ecosystems all the way up the food chain to humans. From local lakes, creeks, and rivers to the exponentially growing dead zones in the sea, and from lawns, gardens, and farms to the atmosphere, the petroleum-intensive production of these toxic chemicals is a major cause of climate change.
We spoke with Mitchell Cohen, chairman of New York City's WBAI Radio and co-founder of the No Spray Coalition, formed in 1999. After local politicians sprayed his city in fear of mosquito-borne West Nile disease, he rolled up his sleeves and got involved.
The manufacture of pesticides is highly energy intensive. It's a very large contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. Also, chemical fertilizers, which add nitrous oxide emissions that are 400 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. There are also synergists, they call them, that are mixed in with the pesticides themselves that make the pesticides even more potent and more dangerous to people and other species. They're also estrogen mimickers and hormone disruptors. We're talking about something that's significantly changing our bodies as well as our environment.
Cohen says neurotoxins invented and used during World War I were adapted by the chemical industry into an indiscriminate pesticide war against bugs and weeds. He says it's counterproductive to kill natural predators such as birds, bats, dragonflies, and ladybugs because in a short time span, the target bugs adapt and flourish, absent their natural predators, creating a short-term solution but long-term degradation.
When you spray pyrethroid or malathion or even an herbicide in your yard, they don't just dissolve or dissipate. They sit there for a while. Your kids play in it. It gets on their toys and their clothes. They track it into the house, and we breathe it in, and we get it on our skin. It also kills all life in the soil.
Ignoring corporate ads and media spin on toxic sprays, citizens around the country are waking up to the threats of these chemicals. Katrina Blair, founder of Turtle Lake Refuge in Southwest Colorado, is a naturalist, writer, and no-spray activist who educates citizens and city councils about natural, undrugged soil.
So the benefits of a drug-free yard are you're encouraging a healthy ecosystem that takes care of itself. Instead of chemical fertilizers and herbicides that are commonly used, you give it a natural compost tea, which is a life force. It breeds life. It helps the grass outcompete other plants. It also creates an incredibly healthy underground ecosystem of all the worms and the microorganisms and the mycelium root structures that creates a healthy breeding ground for healthy plants.
Instead of spraying bugs and weeds, homeowners and renters alike can opt for more natural alternatives like catnip, citronella, pennyroyal, lavender, and peppermint plants and oils. Blair elaborates on compost tea.
Compost tea is becoming more popular in many communities, and you can actually purchase it locally made, or you can make your own very simply by taking finished compost, putting it into a pillowcase, dropping it into a 55-gallon container of water, and aerating it or stirring it for 3 days.
Catherine Goldman, a professional conservationist from Haley, Idaho, makes a career of promoting solutions to vital issues such as toxic sprays used on backyards and public lands. As a leader in the Blaine County Pesticide Action Network, she advocates getting involved in your community.
We can all do our part to help protect ourselves and our planet. And that starts right in our own backyards. You can join a local group that's working on educating people about this issue and providing alternatives to those chemicals. Or, if there's not one right there, just start your own.
One positive force of action that anyone can take is to become an organic land steward of their own backyard. And this will greatly bring nourishment into your own health, your community, and the whole ecosystem from the bees down to the fishes in the ocean.
Good Dirt Radio stories are about folks getting involved in making a difference in their community. Examples of ways that everyone can help shape a better world, a positive voice for change. I'm Tammy Graham.
And I'm Tom Bartels. Thanks for joining us on Good Dirt Radio, digging up good news for a change.
Well, that's all for today's show. I want to thank Jeff Lowenfels, the garden columnist who was with us at the beginning. We heard from Guy Hand with the Market and Garden Report. Keith Malone is the owner of Alaska Honeybee Products. He was talking about beekeeping. And then finally, that Good Dirt Radio piece that we just heard from Durango, Colorado. Our producer and Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.